It's Friday night, it's 7 o'clock, and you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and it's another edition of Little Atoms with Richard Sanderson and me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. We normally talk about something to do with the Enlightenment. I'm going to get straight into the show because we've got a lot to cover today, so I'm going to hand over to Richard to introduce our guest.
Thanks, Neil. Our guest today is Damien Thompson. Damien's the author of The End of Time and Waiting for the Antichrist. He's also the editor-in-chief of the Catholic Herald and a leader writer for the Daily Telegraph, neither of which would make him an obvious guest for a programme like ours, which used to describe itself as atheist and of the left, except for the fact that he's written an excellent book called Counter Knowledge, How We Surrender to Conspiracy Theories, Quack Medicine, Bogus Science and Fake History, a book described by Francis Wheen as an invigorating trumpet blast against the monstrous regiment of 21st century quacks, flat earthers and mumbo-jumbo merchants, loud enough to wake reason from its sleep. And as we on Little Atoms share a radio station with many of that monstrous element, we had to get Damien Thompson on. Damien, welcome to Little Atoms. It's great to have you here. Finished reading your book yesterday, so I'm still full of excitement about it. I wonder, just to kick off, whether we could just have a very quick definition of what you mean by counter-knowledge, and would it just be simpler to describe it as lies?
It would be simple to describe it as lies, but I think it would be a little bit misleading, because a lie implies an intention to deceive. What I'm talking about is, I suppose, fiction masquerading as fact. Stuff that dresses itself up as established fact in the form of science or medicine or history that looks like it, that has all the references, that has the arguments, that has the plausibility, but actually falls apart as soon as you start unpicking those references. And this is really the point of my book, is moving, I think, from the fringes of society into the mainstream, and that's what bothers me.
One of the things you sort of open with, and I have an interesting anecdote about it, is this: there seems to be quite a vogue at the moment to have various conspiracy theories ranging from the fantastical to the really fantastical about 9/11 and the horrendous events of that day, and in particular a film called Loose Change. I'm curious as to why you think it is that this has particularly taken off recently.
Well, Loose Change is a very good piece of work. I mean, it's a masterpiece of counter-knowledge. It's fantastically well edited. It's been through several editions, which I find interesting, because there's one little strand of their mega conspiracy theory is shown to be absolute bullshit. They then have to sort of re-edit it. But it's one very slick piece of work. 9/11 in itself was an enormously, as well as horrifying, dramatic and complex event. If ever anything invited conspiracy theory, it was that. Unfortunately for the victims of 9/11, people have really allowed their imaginations free rein. Some of the most fantastically implausible explanations for what happened on that day have flourished, thanks largely to the presence of new media that simply weren't around at the time of other events that spawned conspiracy theories, such as the Kennedy assassination. In fact, yes. 9/11, I would argue, is a much less mysterious event than the assassination of Kennedy, because at least with the assassination of Kennedy, you have the extraordinary fact that Lee Harvey Oswald spent time in Russia, that Kennedy was having an affair with a woman from the mafia. There are all sorts of relatively plausible alternative scenarios. With 9/11, it's pretty clear that al-Qaeda, with enormous ingenuity, diabolical ingenuity, flew planes into the World Trade Center, and that nobody was expecting it except the terrorists.
One of the things that struck me, because we're now in Britain, we're now getting a whole series of similar sort of conspiracy theories about 7/7, which seems to me, you know, if 9/11, if it's in a massive stretch of the imagination to imagine that in any way was something brought about by the American government, that 7/7 seems even more of a stretch, because, you know, we have the confessions of the people that did it, for
starters. Absolutely. It's as if we've got to have our own one, you know. It's as if the people behind 7/7 would already have been heavily into 9/11 conspiracy theories. So something happens.
Well, this is something I was...
They want their own one, you know? They want 7/7. I don't know to what extent they believe it, but I think it's horrifying that they're able to sort of play with this story and mould it into, effectively, I think, a piece of paranoid entertainment.
I think you're absolutely right on that. And also, you point out in the book, that and this is something, again, I'd like to ask you about, why do you think it is that conspiracy theorists buy the lot? You know, there's not, I can't think of a single conspiracy theorist that would say that 9/11 was an inside job, but 7/7 wasn't. Got to go for both of them.
There's a sort of strange democracy in the paranoid subculture, and I think there always has been for a very long time. Sociologists sometimes use the phrase cultic milieu to describe a subculture in which all ideas are really legitimate, because I suppose in the end nobody has a watertight case for their little fantasy. All these little fantasies require a great deal of tolerance on the part of the believer, a great deal of imagination. And I think there's a sort of unspoken agreement that if you aren't rude about my little fantasy, I won't pick holes in yours, because we all face a common enemy, and then you can build your own conspiracy theory around the common enemy. But there's a certain democracy in this world.
Indeed, I was looking. Sorry, Neil.
You mentioned the idea of the cultic milieu, and it's interesting that in its very title was once upon a time was, you know, marginal, was, you know, people on the outskirts of society, and the internet obviously is what's brought this into the mainstream, as we've already discussed. But so, do you think? So, what are the sort of dangers of this? Do you think? I mean, is there? Where is this going to go?
I mean, I think there are dangers, definitely.
But do you think steps should be taken, or where do we see this sort of leading?
I think steps should be taken, but I don't think they should be. I don't think necessarily the steps that should be taken are the ones that would obviously occur to us. I like the idea of using the weapons of the cultic milieu or counter-knowledge against the counter-knowledge merchants.
Sure.
So I like the idea of websites and blogs and radio stations that ruthlessly examine and, where necessary, mock these fantastic claims. Ben Goldacre of The Guardian and the Bad Science blog has ruthlessly destroyed the reputations of people making ludicrous claims in the world of alternative medicine. It is possible to do that. The other thing I think we need to ask ourselves as taxpayers is whether we want to be funding public institutions that legitimize the spread of information that is not actually backed up by evidence. Because it's a rather old-fashioned, even paternalistic idea, but I think we need to protect the idea of a public domain in which a fact is a fact. And we need to be proud, whether we're left-wing or right-wing, we need to be very proud of the scientific methodology that has enabled us to distinguish between a false claim, a true claim, and, if you like, to pick our way through those many pieces of data which aren't easily explained.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the definition of counter knowledge, and building on what you've just said, you write the Holy Smoke blog for the Telegraph, which is a religious affairs blog,
yeah.
And obviously you're editor-in-chief of the Catholic Herald. So let's talk about why you wouldn't consider mainstream religions to be in the same bracket as counter knowledge.
I think mainstream religions flirt with counter-knowledge. I wouldn't put them in the same bracket as counter-knowledge necessarily. I think we need to exercise a little bit of common sense and say that mainstream religions make claims about the supernatural which, for people who do not subscribe to them, are completely incredible and utter nonsense. But in many cases, those claims are almost entirely transcendent. They relate to a non-material world, and there's no way of, it's just as with the existence of God, there's no way of proving or disproving those claims. I'm an executive of the Catholic Herald, and very happy to serve the community in which I grew up, and very proud of my Catholic background, and do my best to make the paper readable and fun. Big fan of the Pope, this particular Pope. But where I draw the line is when Catholicism or any other religion starts telling me things about the material world which can be shown not to be true. So you can't prove that there's a Holy Spirit. You can't prove that there's a Trinity. But you can prove, I think, or at least demonstrate that there is no evidence to suggest that various miracles are true. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time studying the world of Pentecostal Christianity and saw more bogus healings than I thought possible, and also saw the dreadful social consequences of some of those healing rallies. So I'm very unsympathetic to counter-knowledge in the world of religion, and it drives me absolutely potty. For example, when the Catholic Church starts claiming that condoms don't protect against the spread of AIDS simply because it happens to suit Catholic teaching for that pseudoscientific idea to be accepted. Ben Goldacre makes this point. Ben Goldacre says, I don't mind when religious people have very firmly held convictions about the supernatural or indeed about the morality of various acts, such as abortion. I do mind when they use bogus science to back them up.
Mm.
But this is always going to be an awkward question for me, and I'm not going to gloss over it. It's always going to be a tricky one.
Well, you've sort of brought us on to another one of the subjects covered in counter-knowledge, and I was going to raise the example of the condoms thing. You talk a lot about the sort of alternative medicine side, and we've covered that a lot on the show. But you cover one of the main dangers. You know, a lot of people think that, well, you know, it's harmless. Well, you know, if they're worried, well, want to go to their doctor and get, you know, homeopathy, you know, so what? It's their money. But let's talk about one of the more sinister sides, and this is you've already brought up AIDS in Africa, and how the fight against AIDS is being harmed by the sort of alternative medicine industry. So let's have a talk.
Yes,
about
indeed
that.
It is, and I don't think we could talk about this too often because I just wish more people knew about it. And one of the main reasons for writing this book, actually, is my horror at the effect of alternative medicine. I don't actually think there's such a thing. I think there's just medicine, and there's so-called alternative therapies that don't work or just work as placebos. But as you say, it's one thing to visit your health store and buy the sugar pills and labeled homeopathic medicine, water, whatever, spend money on it. That's your problem. That's your lookout. You may make yourself ill as a result, and I know people who have. It's quite another when vitamin salesmen are going to Southern Africa and saying, look, these natural remedies, which are in tune with your own natural wisdom, there's tremendous sort of patronizing racism about the way they talk to people in Africa about medicine, work better than antiretroviral drugs. So I think alternative medicine is killing people in Southern Africa, no doubt about it at all. And people calling themselves homeopaths are killing people. That's why it makes me so absolutely furious when I hear the Prince of Wales singing the praises of homeopathy, because homeopathy was recognised as ludicrous quackery when it was invented at the beginning of the 19th century, and it's no more sensible now than it was then.
Well, of course, it doesn't help when Mabeke.
Of course it doesn't. Of course it doesn't. It doesn't help when, if I can, sorry to be so rude about the Catholic Church, I hope I'll be forgiven for this, but it doesn't help when the Archbishop of Maputo says that Western drug companies are deliberately infecting condoms with the AIDS virus.
Well, it's those two sort of things. Interestingly, there's two conspiracy theories there that are sort of meeting, and there is another one in that in Nigeria or something. There was a sort of imams were going around saying that the inoculation was a sort of, you know, Western plot. Sterilise Muslims or something, and there's all this sort of conspiracy theory that's sort of tying into the same thing.
And it's amazing the adaptability. You can, the same conspiracy theory can be customised with just a few light cosmetic changes for an Islamic or a Christian audience. But the effects are the same and as dangerous.
Indeed, it seems to me that one of the factors about a good conspiracy theory, if I can use that phrase, is that it as soon as it has a bit of evidence which, you know, denies part of it, it just invents another part of it so that it can keep mutating and being believed. Speaking of injections, reminds me of the fact that the you know, just this week, there's been another massive and no doubt costly survey into whether there's any links whatsoever between MMR and autism. And unsurprisingly, perhaps to us, it turns out there is no link whatsoever. Yet again, this has been proven that there's no link whatsoever. And I'm wondering whether, you know, are we finally going to see the nail in the coffin on this one, or do you envisage this particular theory just continuing?
I think opinion is shifting away from Wakefield's thesis, but not fast enough. I still hear people saying, at dinner parties, that piece of research may have been dodgy, but I feel that there's something wrong with loading a child with so many vaccines at the same time. Ken Livingston said, common sense, or I can't quote him exactly, but he said, it tells you that you shouldn't give a child of that age three vaccinations at once. What the bloody hell does Ken Livingston know about it?
No, that was an appalling thing to say. It really
was. Another reason not to vote for him, in my opinion.
I suppose it is difficult when you're confronted with somebody whose child has autism and they're saying, I don't tell me that this didn't do it. It's my child. I know this is what happened.
It's very, very difficult. And obviously you have to be sensitive about it. But in the end, somebody's got to tell them, because we're moving into a world. It's a whole intellectual landscape, I think, in which the authenticity of personal experience is taking over from data. And that means that everything is judged according to emotion rather than reason.
If it's true for you, then it's true.
Which is a line I use because it is one of the slogans of that citadel of counter-knowledge, the Church of Scientology. If it's true for you, it's true.
Well, we should probably move on rapidly from them. We know how litigious they are. Another one.
What a shame that one does have to move on rapidly from them, because I would have absolutely no qualms at all in saying that Dianetics is a form of counter-knowledge, that lots of the particularly the claims that Hubbard made early on about Dianetics were proven to be utter nonsense at the time. And one of the reasons Scientology has reinvented itself as a church is that the science of Dianetics was exposed as quackery so early on.
Well, another one of the reasons I wanted to move on is because I haven't actually written any questions on Scientology. So let's talk about pseudo-history, which is one of another areas that you cover. There's, interestingly, two sort of strands to this. So let's talk about, first of all, The Da Vinci Code, which obviously was, you know, a massive bestseller, and has obviously given publishing houses the sort of key to say this is something that we can obviously make a lot of money off. We also thought it'd be interesting to ask if this was one that particularly riled you, because it's a book that gives the Catholic Church a bit of a kicking as well. It's particularly offensive about.
It is. Well, I have to say, having just been very rude about some Catholic claims, that it does rile me enormously that so many conspiracy theories have this vicious anti-Catholic subtext to them. The Da Vinci Code is based on a ludicrous anti-Catholic conspiracy theory for which there's no evidence whatsoever, which was first unveiled. I was going to say it was first unveiled in The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, but actually it was borrowed by the authors of that dreadful book from earlier fraudulent books. But yes, it's amazing how often the Catholic Church turns out to be the villain of the piece, rather in the way that the Jews turned out to be the villain of the piece, actually, and still do in many of these conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. So, I didn't actually read it. I've never read it, and I've seen the film, which was, I got about a third.
It's such a bad novel. I got about a third of the way through, and I thought, I get it. I know what he's trying to say.
2 hours of my life that I'm never going to get back.
Exactly.
From that film. Exactly. But that was a novel, although I didn't actually realise until I read your book that he sort of posits it as sort of based on facts.
Yep.
But you also talk about this book, 1421, The Year China Discovered the World. So tell us a little bit about that.
1421, I think, has sold a million copies. While I was researching the book, I found it on sale in the history section of all the major chains, and two major chains were offering it as a special deal. It's not history at all. It's the fantastic imagination of a retired naval commander called Gavin Menzies, who thinks that a Chinese fleet discovered everywhere from, I'm not kidding, from New Zealand to Greenland in the 1420s without anybody noticing he came out with his book.
I can kind of understand why this book might be popular in China, but I don't really guess why it's selling a million copies worldwide.
It's extremely slickly done. The whole story of how 1421 was concocted has been told by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation in a very good TV documentary called Four Corners. That's part of the series. It's called Junk History, the particular documentary. And what happened basically is Menzies came up with the idea, and as the documentary shows, they worked out it could be a bestseller, and a whole team of researchers, rather than fact checkers, let's put it politely, were put onto it, and he didn't write very much of the book, as he admits. The support of the Chinese government is very significant, I think. Also the support of Western capitalists who stand to make quite a lot of money out of anything that excites the Chinese government. Because although I am definitely come from the right as opposed to the left and am a believer in free markets, there's no doubt at all that capitalist greed plays a very important part in the circulation of counter-knowledge.
Okay, so, well, that's a strand of... actually, 1421 is being sold as history. I was going to say Da Vinci Code is a strand of fiction that's sort of posing as this. Let's talk about the idea of the Afrocentrism and the sort of history that's being taught in universities as history, but that is bogus in this sort of way that's to I suppose the trite way of saying it is to make sort of minority groups feel a bit better about
that's
it.
That's right.
And I have to say, it's been around for a long time, because when I studied teaching over 20 years ago, we were all told to read Black Athena.
Yeah.
This is absolutely on our reading lists as teachers.
There's a whole spectrum of Afrocentric history. Black Athena, I suppose, occupies a respectable end of the spectrum. And then there's the stuff you can buy in on the street in Brixton. Most Afrocentric history is based on a fiction that the great achievements of the ancient Greeks were stolen from Egypt, and that the civilization of Egypt itself was the product of black Africans, which is a complicated but basically untrue claim. I think it is profoundly disturbing that people from a particular ethnic minority are being fed a version of history that is tailored for their race, effectively. Because surely we've moved beyond the point at which somebody's racial and ethnic background should affect the veracity of the information that they're being... Yes, by all means, you can look at history from different perspectives, but the idea that it is appropriate to tell black students what are essentially fabrications about African history is really offensive.
And as you point out, it's actually... It's almost a sort of variation on the old Eric von Daniken chariot of the gods idea that no civilization can possibly come up with these ideas without sort of it starting somewhere else.
Absolutely. It's known as hyperdiffusionism, is the phenomenon, is the idea that any great ancient civilization stole or was brought its ideas from somewhere else. And as people living in Latin America have pointed out, there's something very unpleasant and really racist about the idea that their enormous achievements actually were the product of undiscovered voyages from the old world.
Yeah, the great...
Aurelians.
Aurelians, for that matter.
Well, the great rationalist
James
Randi. The
whole Mormon religion, by the way, is built on that ludicrous counter-knowledge.
James Randi said it was one of the most racist ideologies around,
concept, yeah. But it's respectable up to a point, anyway. In certain universities, even in some of the best universities, versions of it are respectable because it's considered racist to challenge it, which is why I'm so pleased to see it being challenged from the left rather than the right.
So, we've only got 5 minutes left, so I think it's unavoidable that we should ask your opinion on Rowan Williams and his comments. So, Damien, what would you think would be the problems with importing some aspects of Sharia law into into Britain.
Rowan Williams has made an absolute idiot of himself, and I think proved his unfitness for the office that he holds. But let's look at the potential links between Sharia and counter-knowledge. Sharia, which is a medieval code of Islam, basically, based on the Quran, but nonetheless developed quite a long time afterwards. A Sharia society, a proper Sharia society, is often a totalitarian society, which, like all totalitarian societies, is based on feeding people myths about the past. And you will find that the Islamic world generally is a very, very rich source of counter-knowledge generally, whether it's creationism or pseudoscience. And the fact that Sharia law operates with such terrifying force in parts of the Islamic world means that supposedly respectable universities teach this, and you're not allowed to challenge it. So we all have a go, quite rightly, at American institutions that teach creationism, although publicly funded universities don't teach creationism in America, but in the Islamic world, it's taught just about everywhere and more or less illegal to teach anything else. That's the sort of, not knowing that is the sort of naivety with which I associate Rowan Williams.
I wonder if we could just finish off, because we've only got a couple of minutes left, by taking a slightly more, maybe a positive slant, and just say, you mentioned earlier that there are ways of fighting back, and perhaps by using their own weapons against them, i.e. the internet. And I'm wondering if you can recommend some websites, apart from your own, as well as your own excellent counterknowledge.com.
Well, counterknowledge.com does have a blog role. I'm a frequent visitor to Ben Goldacre's excellent Bad Science. There's one called Quack Watch, and
I'd like to put in a word for I think it's called, yes, it's Screw Loose Change, which is
Screw Loose Change is fantastic. Screw Loose Change is actually, what's good about Screw Loose Change is that there's a version of Loose Change in which it's 3 hours long, in which they stop the film every time it tells a porky and they explain why it's wrong. So it takes 3 hours to watch the thing, but by the end of it, you'll no doubt that you've watched a very nasty piece of propaganda.
If you listen to this show and you listen to some of the other shows on Resonance that propound the theories in Loose Change, I do recommend you go to Screw Loose Change just to see the other argument.
Good idea.
But, Damien, thank you very much for joining us for the last half hour.
It's been a great pleasure.
The book is a great and fantastic speedy read, it has to be said as well. It's you rattle through it. It's published by Atlantic Books. It's $12.99. It's in your bookshops now, and I recommend it highly. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Damien Thompson, Richard Sanderson, and Neil Denny, and Little Atoms. Thanks
for listening.